Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty has the day off. You might call the small Alaskan village of Shaktulik a sort of ground zero for climate change in America. Scientists say Alaska is warming at twice the rate of the continental United States, and Shaktulik is located on a spit of land on the state's western coast and is increasingly vulnerable to powerful storms that roll in from the Bering Sea. Approximately 250 people live in Shaktulik, and the choice is clear. Stay and try to figure out a way to fortify homes or join an increasing number of climate change refugees across the globe. We'll start the hour with an in-depth look at Shaktulik's story, and then later we'll broaden the conversation to include the latest on climate change policy and the incoming Trump administration. And as always, here's the number if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. You can send us an email if you like at radiotimes@whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So we welcome Erica Good, science and environment reporter for The New York Times, who visited Shaktulik recently to get the story firsthand. Hello, Erica.
Hi, Mary. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
And also, Erica, I just want to say that Josh Hayner took some spectacular photos on this assignment, and I'd like to let our listeners know we'll share those on our Facebook page.
He absolutely did, yes.
Yeah, they really are just fascinating to look at. Erica, if you would, give us a sense of this place, Shaktulik and its people. There's a school there, but is there a grocery store? Yeah, how do they receive supplies? What did you find out?
As you mentioned, Mary, this is a tiny native village on the west coast of Alaska on the Norton Sound. It is kind of squished in between the Tuguminik River on one side and the Norton Sound on the other. It's a very narrow spit of land. It only has one road that is lined on both sides by these very colorful, different color houses, two rows of them. It has a school. It has two small stores. And as you know, Alaskan natives, you know, the land is sovereign land of the Alaskan Native people. So there's a complicated government structure, which is both, you know, the city, the tribe, and the corporation, which actually owns the land.
And for just a quick look at the town's history, it ended up on this coastal sand spit courtesy of the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs back in the 1930s?
Yes. The different Native tribes have been in the region for actually thousands of years. The Inupiat tribes came down from the north more recently, and the village actually was in two different places before its current location. At one point, it was 6 miles inland up the Shaktulik River, and that was quite a protected place because it was a little bit farther inland. But in the 1930s, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was going to build a, which is responsible for providing education to Native kids, and they built a school. They brought a barge in, and they weren't actually able, or they, for whatever reason, they didn't bring the materials inland. They just sort of dumped them onto the spit there. It's a 3-mile-long spit, and they built the school there. And, of course, you know, this is a fairly remote location. There wasn't any road, really, and no transportation for the kids. So the village itself moved to this area on the spit farther south, a little bit farther south on the spit from where they are now. But it turned out that this was a very exposed area to the storms that come, as you say, barreling in. They actually come from the Aleutians. And the village sustained quite a bit of damage in the 60s, series of storms. And at some point, they just realized that they were going to have to move. They held a series of community meetings. There were two proposals. One was to move up inland again near the foothills Another was to move to their current location, which is about 3 miles further up the spit. And the problem with moving to the foothills, some people in the village felt, was that, you know, this is a very subsistence culture. They really depend on hunting, fishing, for their food supply, for their culture. They've been doing this for thousands of years. And there were people who didn't want to move because they thought they would be too far away from the water, from the ocean and the river. And
were
they took a vote. Yeah, sorry.
No. I was just going to jump in. They do hunt. Which whale is it that they hunt in that area?
The beluga.
Yeah.
The bowheads don't actually come in that. To that, the water's too shallow for them. But actually, when I was there, the villagers told me that there was a time, quite a long time ago, when there was a bowhead that they caught, and they didn't really know what to do with it. It's so huge. So, but they do hunt beluga, they hunt moose, they hunt ducks and other fowl. Anyway, so they took a vote, and by three votes, the decision was to move to their current location.
Okay. So where they are now on this coastal spit is it's even more exposed than it has been, if I'm correct, because it's believed because of climate change. Winter is now arriving later. Spring is coming earlier. So physically for the town, tell us about what this means in connection with offshore ice.
So there's no question that the sea ice in the Bering Sea is decreasing. The Alaska is in close proximity to the Arctic, which, as you mentioned, is warming. Pardon me, faster than any other part of the U.S. and many parts of the globe. And Alaska has all these native villages that are right on the coast for the reasons that we just talked about, that they depend on the water as a source of food. And they're all in trouble. There are dozens of them. They're all in trouble. Shaktulik is vulnerable, particularly because there are these huge storms that come in. The storms have the force of a Category 1 hurricane, but they're much larger. They're like 5 or 10 times the diameter of a hurricane. And because they're the ice, offshore ice, normally in the fall and winter when the storms come, provides a kind of barrier that buffers the effects of the storms, both of the storm surges and the waves that are coming in. But as that ice has decreased over the years, and last year there was actually people in the village say no ice at all for the first time that anyone can remember.
Really?
That buffer is, you know, disappearing. And so the impact of the storms is greater. And there's been quite a bit of erosion, which is continuing of the land. By one estimate, they're losing almost an acre a year.
Mm.
And in 50 years, they could lose 45 acres off of that 3 mile spit, of which the village takes up about 1.1 square miles.
So, Erica, for the moment, the residents of Shaktulik say they will stay and defend, as you put it. So there's this mile long berm and there's this $100 million wish list. What does that consist of?
Well, I think the first thing on it is really an evacuation road. There is no reliable way to quickly evacuate this village. They have an airport. It's a little strip of gravel, landing strip, where only small planes can come in. And there is no road out of the village. So some people say that they're going to take their boats and escape up the river. But, of course, in the wintertime and in the late fall, the winter is icy. It's because it's, you know, very shallow, much shallower water. It's icy. It's treacherous. And some people actually did try to kind of escape from a storm on the river, and they ended up having to be, you know, located and rescued back into the village. So that's not really a viable option. And it's very scary to be in a place that you can't get out of quickly during one of these storms.
So that's
really one of the top things on the list. But there are also things like having a better fortified shelter for people in the village, which they have. You know, currently people go to the school, but the school's right on the ocean, and it's not clear that the school will itself be a safe place.
So, as I mentioned a moment ago, they want $100 million to help achieve some sort of protection against the encroaching seas and storms. Is this funding at all certain? The Obama administration has proposed $400 million to relocate villages, but is this likely to materialize in the incoming Trump administration?
Well, one reason that the village has decided to pretty much try to stay where it is, although they know that they may eventually have to leave anyway, is that it's so difficult to get the money to physically move a village. It can cost $200 million or more. And this, even these things that they're asking for to stay, it's the money just is really difficult to find. So far, it hasn't materialized for any of these villages really around Alaska. The federal and state agencies are very reluctant to give money to a village that is threatened by erosion and by flooding, to give money for infrastructure in that village. And when a village says that it's intending to relocate, it's a problematic for grants and for funding that might depend on the fact that the village is, you know, going to stay where it is. So they're really in this double bind. And there is, as you mentioned, there's money set aside in the 2017 proposed budget from the Obama administration, but that was always, you know, a question. And now with the new administration, which has not been very supportive of climate change efforts so far, coming in, it's unclear what's going to happen to that money. And really, even that $400 million, given that you have dozens of villages that are in need of money, is not enough.
Yeah, that was the next question. We've got about 30 seconds to the break, Erica. Just a quick question about the villagers. They know that they're facing this difficult decision, and for the moment they've made the decision to stay. Tell me about the anxiety. Some of them must have expressed some anxiety to you about this.
Well, you know, I started the piece that I wrote about this with a dream that a woman had about flooding, and that's really very common there. People have dreams about flooding all the time. So it's always kind of in the back of their mind that this could happen.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about Shaktulik with Erica Good, science and environment reporter at The New York Times, after the break here. And if you'd like to join the conversation, here's the number, 888-477-9499. Stay with us. There's more just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and we're joined for the next few minutes by Erica Good, who is science and environment reporter at The New York Times. We've been talking about the tiny village of Shaktulik in Alaska, a tiny village of about 250 people. They're right on the ocean on the west coast of Alaska, and they are apparently affected by climate change in that sea ice is not appearing and they're not protected by powerful storms, but they have made the decision for the moment to stay, Erica. And you also write of the town in Alaska called, I think it's, is it Newtok, which has made the decision to leave. So how does that work?
Yes, Mary. Well, Newtok is in the south part, south of Shaktulik. It's in an area called the Yukon. I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but Kuskokwim Delta. It's a very soggy area. If you look at it on a map, it's really hard to tell almost, you know, what's water and what's land. There's so much water there. And Newtok has been in trouble for quite a while. They benefited from and Congress in 2005 authorizing the Army Corps of Engineers to have money to help some of these villages try to move or else, you know, try to shore up where they are located. And NewTech started a move. They have a couple of houses that they've moved to an area across the river. But they say, and people are kind of going back and forth, but they are nowhere near completely moved. And the money, pardon me, that bill that Congress provided the authorization of that money under was rescinded in 2009. So that money is no longer available, and the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, can't anymore go in to help NewTech or two other villages where it built these very sturdy revetments, Shishmaref and Kivalina, which are both north on the Bering Sea, where this is a stopgap measure, but it certainly, you know, fairly solid stopgap measure. They built these very sturdy revetments to help keep the erosion down.
So another quick question for you, Erica, before we have to let you go. When there's an effort to move a town, is there generally an effort to, in planning, to replicate the structure of the town in the new location?
Well, it's a question of moving not just the houses, but the infrastructure. So in Shaktulik, for example, there's two wind turbines that generate a lot of the electricity for the village. There's all the complicated, you know, infrastructure that any village has to go with it. So, and it's also in these remote locations, it's a very difficult prospect to actually move structures from one place to another. It's not like other parts of the United States where you can just load them onto a truck and drive them away.
Yeah, so a challenging process, and we thank you for bringing us up to speed on a climate change story which continues to unfold. Erica Good, science and environmental reporter for The New York Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
And now it's Susan Phillips' turn. Susan is an energy and environment reporter with WHYY and State Impact Pennsylvania. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Mary.
So you reported from the Marrakesh Climate Change Conference a couple of weeks ago. It was the first major meeting of nations to follow the Paris Climate Change Accord. Review for us just briefly the goal of the Paris Agreement.
So the Paris Agreement was pretty historical in that finally all the countries came together and agreed to reduce their emissions. And the technical goal is to keep warming below 2 degrees average. It took so many years to get there. There are so many failed climate accords. And so the U.S. was such a big part of making this happen because Obama went and made a deal with China. I don't know if, you know, listeners may remember that. So coming into Marrakesh, everyone was just so optimistic. The goal of Marrakesh was a little less ambitious in that it was really sort of a follow-up to Paris. It was, okay, we got this deal on the table. How are we going to make it work?
Was it going to try to take Paris just a little bit closer in terms of the goal of keeping warming to that 2 degrees Celsius limit?
That was the discussion ahead of time, was that from the most recent scientific reports that Paris is not ambitious enough. It has to get even below. We have to keep the emissions to the point where it's even, you know, the warming is even further below 2 degrees in order not to see the same impacts across the globe as we've just heard is already happening in Alaska. It's already happening in other parts of the world.
Yeah. So speaking of other parts of the world, following the election of Donald Trump, what did you briefly hear and see from participants at Marrakesh?
So as you can imagine, it was pretty much of a shock over there, just like it was here. People were very upset. But what was surprising to me, Mary, was that soon after that, people just became, you know, defiantly optimistic. This is going to keep going. There's momentum already, business momentum, and momentum among other countries that this is not going to fall apart.
Okay. Well, you know, the U.S. has pledged money to help poor nations achieve the Paris Accord goals. Approximately how much has been pledged, Susan, and how would this money be spent? What's the goal there?
Right. So the U.S. pledged $3 billion, and Obama has already sent $500 million to what's called the Green Climate Fund. Everybody, once Trump was elected, everyone was really worried, especially those from really poor countries, that this money was going to dry up. It's not going to come. And if that were to be the case, then it could sort of have a domino effect and the Paris Agreement could fall apart. So that's a big question, like a lot of things with Trump. We don't know what he's going to do. He certainly said he's not going to pay that money. But then, you know, a couple days after the climate talks in Marrakesh ended, he told the New York Times, well, maybe I'll have an open mind about climate change. Yeah. And the money's going to help these poor countries do what you just heard is needs to be done in Alaska, right? Yeah. Towns need to move. There needs to be, you know, water, you know, healthy water supplies. There needs to be infrastructure changes and upgrades. It's pretty much the same thing.
If the U.S. were to pull out of the Paris Accord, some states and cities are pledging to stay involved in efforts to reduce carbon emissions. California is one. So Susan, what can states like California realistically achieve in keeping with the Paris Accord? Can this keep U.S. participation kind of going?
Yeah, this is what's really interesting. I mean, obviously, California and cities like Philadelphia can't sign global treaties. But one of the things that everyone kept talking about in Marrakesh was, well, to keep this alive, almost to keep it on life support for the next 4 years, is there a way that we can incorporate what places like California or the Northeast states or cities like New York and Philadelphia have already pledged to do to reduce their emissions? It's not going to make up for what the U.S. is supposed to do. But, you know, it's sort of like one of those things, you know, trying to see the silver lining.
Yeah. So, and as you mentioned earlier, there was a sense of kind of standing and saying, okay, we're going to perhaps fight back, and even a sense of optimism.
A sense of optimism, yes. But again, it's kind of strange because at this point, they're just trying to hold on to what has already been pledged. And like you said before, people have already figured out that more needs to be done quicker. So,
well, thanks for joining us with your thoughts from the Marrakesh Conference. Susan Phillips, an energy and environment reporter with WHYY and State Impact Pennsylvania. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And joining us for the remainder of the hour to take more of a look at climate change policy and the Trump administration, Evan Lehman is deputy editor of Climate Wire at E&E News, an online media company which offers daily coverage of environmental and energy policy and markets. Welcome, Evan.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeremy Shulman is senior project manager for Climate Desk, a project of Mother Jones Magazine. Hello, Jeremy.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So a few weeks back, President-elect Donald Trump appeared to, as we just were talking about it with Susan Phillips, soften his position about the Paris Climate Accord, saying he has an open mind. This is, of course, an apparent about face from his campaign promise to pull the U.S. out of the agreement. Evan, how do you read this?
I would be skeptical in describing it as an about face. The full context of that interview also showed that he has deep skepticism himself about climate science and what should be done about it and using sort of the domestic forces of our economy to address it. He has, as you mentioned, promised to pull out of Paris during the campaign, and he has backtracked somewhat on that. At this point, we don't know what he's going to do. There are voices, you know, that are in his transition team that have expressed sort of, a different scenario that goes something like this: threaten to pull out of Paris and see what you can get in return for not doing that, like on trade, for example, or other sort of international agreements that, you know, other nations might bend to in order to keep the U.S. in the Paris Climate Agreement.
Jeremy, what do you think? Do you think that this is a pretty good bargaining chip, Paris, when it comes to maybe renegotiating trade agreements? for the incoming president?
I mean, that's an interesting point. I think that, you know, if there's one constant in Donald Trump's worldview over the last 5 years or so, it's that he's become increasingly more skeptical and committed to not doing anything on climate change. I think it's a mistake, perhaps, to assume that, like with many of his other positions, he hasn't actually thought this one through. He has a long record. He has several years or six or seven years ago, he was on record calling for urgent climate action. But ever since then, ever since the ClimateGate emails where, you know, a bunch of scientists' emails were hacked and they were kind of falsely described as a conspiracy to fabricate data about global warming, Trump has been really, really adamant that global warming is a hoax. And, you know, he made those comments to the New York Times that he has an open mind on climate science and that he has an open mind on the Paris Climate Agreement. But just days later, Rince Priebus was on Fox News and he was, you know, basically assuring Trump supporters that really Trump believes that climate science is mostly bunk. So I kind of think we should probably take him at his word when, you know, he says he wants to cancel the agreement.
All right. Well. Okay. So nearly 200 countries signed this the Paris Accord. If Mr. Trump yanks U.S. involvement, how do co-signers react, and what is the real world fallout for the U.S.? Evan.
You know, that's a very good question, and the answer, I just don't know. I don't know the answer, and I don't think many other people do either. There would be some of this depends on how Trump does pull out. He is also, you know, part of how he pulls out involves removing the United States from the United Nations framework on convention on climate change, no, which would even be a deeper move.
Well, Evan, briefly, what is that? What is the UN framework convention?
So that's a treaty that was struck in 1992. And you know, that basically set the stage for Paris and set the stage for a global movement to reduce greenhouse gases. And if the U.S. were to remove ourselves from that, that means that we are no longer involved in negotiations on anything related to climate. Not just canceling Paris, but we also wouldn't be at all of these COP meetings where climate policy globally is discussed. And supporters of not doing that say that that would be a huge backslide for the United States to remove itself from its leadership position globally on something that affects all sorts of different things economically.
And Jeremy Shulman, do we have a sense of what the ramifications might be if the U.S. were to pull out of the U.N. framework convention, or is it too early to tell?
Well, I think there's a couple important points there. One is that I think the reaction of experts and leaders in China has been particularly telling, that their response to Trump threatening to pull out of the agreement hasn't been to also threaten to pull out of the agreement. It's to talk about how China is going to assume, you know, leadership over world movements to develop clean energy and to cut emissions. And obviously they have a domestic political situation where they really have to clean up their act because of the horrible pollution, yeah, in China. So it doesn't seem, you know, it's not clear cut that the entire agreement would fall apart just because the U.S. pulled out. But, you know, one of the things about Paris was that the agreement that was reached, what was really important about it was that they were going to come back and presumably under U.S. leadership, continue to ratchet up the emissions reductions. They agreed, you know, to limit climate change to between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius, which was very ambitious. And the individual commitments from each of the countries didn't get anywhere close to meeting that that goal. And then the actual policy commitments that the U.S. has made don't really get us to where the U.S. Overall emissions reduction commitment in the Paris Agreement is. So without an administration in the U.S. that's very committed to continuing to ramp up emissions reductions and continuing to negotiate for stronger commitments from other countries, we really can't get anywhere close to this 2-degree goal. Mm-hmm. So it's not like we can just put everything on hold for 4 years or 8 years and go right back to where we were and assume that we can prevent the worst effects of climate change, because kind of by doing nothing, we're going backward.
Well, let me just jump in here with something that I was reading. I believe it was in the New York Times. Ted Norhaus and Jessica Loveling of the Breakthrough Institute say that even if President Trump pulls the U.S. from the Paris Accord, as long as Trump keeps the nation's nuclear power plants online, continues tax incentives for wind and solar, stays out of the way of shale production, the quote from them is, the U.S. might outperform the commitments that the Obama administration made in Paris. Is that overly optimistic, Jeremy?
I mean, I think that's an interesting point. I don't know enough about, you know, sort of the energy economics to know. And the Breakthrough Institute is they're a very pro-nuclear group.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to keep in mind, though, that we shouldn't assume that Donald Trump is not going to do anything to interfere with, especially, wind power. I mean, he has a long record of opposing wind power.
Why is that?
Well, you know, in some cases, opposing wind power because it's unsightly and it's near, you know, the wind turbines are too near his golf clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But in other instances, you know, just during the campaign, he you know, went on a long rant about how wind turbines were killing all the birds.
Yeah. I was just going to say, hold that thought, because we're up against a break. We'll pick up on that in just a moment here on Radio Times. Jeremy Shulman is Senior Project Manager for Climate Desk. Evan Lehman, Deputy Editor of Climate Wire at E&E News. We're talking about climate change and the incoming Trump administration. And there's more in just a moment. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, joined for the remainder of the hour by Evan Lehman, the deputy editor of Climate Wire at E&E News, and Jeremy Shulman, senior project manager for Climate Desk, a project of Mother Jones magazine. And we're taking a look at how President-elect Donald Trump could change America's direction on climate change policy. We went into the break talking about Mr. Trump's sentiments toward wind energy. And Evan Lehman, I have a quote here from Robert Stavins of Harvard, who says, the most important factor in terms of carbon emissions in the United States is the price of natural gas. So, again, don't mean to throw you a curveball, but do you have any information about how this might figure into the picture?
So what I think Stavins is referring to there is the offsetting effect of gas on coal. So as long as natural gas stays cheap, coal effectively stays more expensive, and you use more natural gas that way because it has fewer carbon emissions. So what I assume that he's talking about is sort of this ongoing economic sort of atmosphere or environment in the energy sector where natural gas is displacing coal at power plants. So you know, under that scenario, you're going to drive down greenhouse gases just through the economic. Through the economic markets, and you don't even necessarily need regulation to do that.
Got it. So, well, how might this then affect Donald Trump's promise to put coal miners back to work?
Well, it's interesting because he also supports fracking and expanded natural gas. So those are competing elements, we wrote stories. We examined that process in the campaign, and what we found is that it's a really tall order for Trump to literally put miners back to work and reopen mines, especially in Appalachia, where, you know, the coal seams are deeper and thinner and harder to get to than out in Wyoming. and more expensive, therefore, to extract, especially compared to natural gas.
Let's get to Myrony Bell, who is responsible for the Environmental Protection Agency transition under President-elect Trump. And Jeremy Shulman, he is known to be a climate change denier. Who is he exactly? And does he have anything of a science background?
So Myron Ebell is he's an official at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which is a kind of a libertarian, free market, anti-government regulation think tank, and has been one of the leading sources of climate denial over the last decade or so. And he's kind of been all over making the case that the scientists are lying about the data, and that global warming at the very least is overstated, and that it's not a danger. And I'm not actually certain what, if any, his science background is. But regardless, his positions are in the extreme minority of people who are involved in climate policy.
Yeah, he's been quoted as arguing that warming is actually a good outcome, especially for people like Minnesotans and others who face hard winters.
Right.
Sounds as if he's admitting there's some climate change happening.
Sure. And honestly, you know, Donald Trump made that same argument in that famous New York Times interview from a couple of weeks ago. He claimed that sea level rise would actually be a good thing for a couple of his golf courses that were a little bit farther from the water.
All right. Well, listen, Donald Trump said on the campaign trail he would dismantle the EPA. Evan, how likely do you think this is to happen?
You know, I don't think it's very likely. You know, he's got there's thousands of career bureaucrats in EPA, and it's very difficult to just fire those people. There's laws protecting their employment.
Well, how might he reshape the EPA then?
Yeah, well, that's what Myron Ebell is up to right now, is heading the transition team for EPA. So, you know, today and for the next several weeks, Myron Ebell and his small landing team at EPA are interviewing bureaucrats and officials and political appointees at EPA to try and determine what rules have gone in place when and what hiring practices are occurring. And they're drawing up a new direction for the agency that, you know, could potentially be considered by Trump when he steps in on January 20th. And so, you know, as you noted, Myron Ebell, you know, is a climate skeptic who thinks that warming might be occurring and might be occurring because of humans, but it's so imperceptible that it doesn't have any damage. So, you know, it's safe to assume, I think, that he is sort of identifying people who would fill the ranks at EPA who sort of see the world in the same way.
Well, and Jeremy, what recourse might environmental groups have to changes that Ebell might help affect?
Well, I mean environmental groups are, I think they're worried. And I think they realize that they don't have a ton of official levers of power left in Washington or even in the states. Environmental leaders that we've talked to have really focused on the need to ramp up a grassroots movement. And they point to the early years of Bush's second term, for instance, when Republicans controlled most of Washington, and claim that there's some, you know, there's some grassroots activism and pressure that individual citizens can put on their representatives to kind of stop what they see as the worst regressions in climate policy. Beyond that, they're threatening a lot of lawsuits, and
so they could tie up some of these potential changes for quite a while.
Potentially, yeah. You know, every rule change, every new law can be subject to any number of lawsuits, and certainly Donald Trump will have an opportunity to appoint a number of members of the federal bench and at least one Supreme Court justice to kind of tip things in his favor, but that will take a while.
Let's look at least one of President-elect Trump's potential nominees to head the EPA, and that is Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Evan Lehman, a foe of President Obama's clean power plan?
Yes, that's right. He's, you know, he's one of about two dozen state AGs who have, you know, sued to stop the clean power plan. And, you know, he goes back farther than that, too. And he's also sued to stop the EPA from finding an endangerment finding, which essentially says that greenhouse gases affect human health and the environment negatively. So he's been active in the courts and in the public sphere for a number of years on climate policy.
So Democrats, of course, are in the minority in the Senate. Some have already indicated they will fight any nominee who denies climate change. I believe New Jersey Democrat Cory Booker is among them. But, you know, realistically, Democrats are going to have to engage some moderate Republicans here to circumvent his eventual choice. What are the odds this can happen, Jeremy?
I'd say low. I think that a couple of Senate Republicans who were kind of the most mainstream on climate change and climate policy both lost their Senate races. Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire and Mark Kirk from Illinois had both come out in favor of the Clean Power Plan, and they both lost to Democrats who are you know, also pretty progressive on climate. But there's not a lot of environmental moderates left in the Senate for Democrats to reach out to.
All right, let's get back to China for a moment. You know, we were talking about how China has said it wants to be a world leader and sticking, I guess, with the Paris Accord and affecting good climate change policy. But, you know, Chinese coal is apparently the biggest contributor to carbon emissions. Am I right about that, Evan?
Well, yes. China, as far as I know, China is the biggest contributor of greenhouse gas emissions in the world now, and that is largely because of coal.
So, and even as China might well end up attempting to lead the global fight against climate change, it's also apparently ramping up coal production, because as I was reading in published reports, there's apparently a concern about electricity blackouts. Have you heard this? And if so, how do you read this?
Well, you know, it's a longstanding concern, I think, you know, that China, you know, didn't, as part of its Paris promise, it didn't agree to stop or to start reducing emissions until well into the future, by, I think, 2030 or so, at which point its emissions would peak, and then it would begin to back off of its greenhouse gas emissions. And that, you know, really wrangled Republicans a lot and, you know, prompted them to say that Obama is sort of giving away the House with his negotiating skills and things like that. But, you know, the fact is that China is a growing economy and it's got a huge number of people who are, you know, still striving to be in the middle class and get out of sort of the lowest levels of poverty. So, you know, this is a country that is still developing in a lot of ways.
And again, at the same time, China apparently boasts the largest program in the world to build wind turbines and install solar panels. Jeremy, do you see this ramping up of China's coal production as perhaps a temporary blip on the radar?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Evan said, it's a concern, and you know, we don't really know. They've promised to peak their emissions, you know, sometime around 2030, as Evan said. And what's really kind of important to keep in mind is that while China has the largest carbon footprint in the world, the per capita carbon footprint, the per capita emissions that each individual person is responsible for in China is far below the United States and probably never will catch up to the United States. What Chinese leaders are looking for, and what the kind of what the world needs to stave off climate change, is for you know, these big developing countries like China and India to find a way to kind of catch up to the West in terms of quality of life without going through something that looks like the U.S. you know, industrial revolution emissions-wise.
So the U.S. a few weeks ago apparently announced an ambitious goal to rapidly reduce greenhouse gases by 2050. Emissions would be cut 80% by that time compared to levels set in 2005. You know, this is a really bad pun here, but is the Obama administration tilting at windmills in announcing this goal, considering the incoming Trump administration? What do you think, Evan?
I think that's an apt analogy. You know, as Jeremy said earlier, the United States Paris commitments, you know, are lacking. What we can do to meet the goal hasn't exactly been spelled out. And that was even under the hopeful sort of idea that for climate activists that Hillary Clinton would be leading the way. And there were, you know, that would entail new regulations, perhaps on oil refineries, perhaps on industry, perhaps on other segments of the economy that are not yet regulated for greenhouse gases to achieve the Paris goals. So you know, now under a Trump administration, not only are those future emission policies out the window, but the existing ones that the United States had put in place that didn't quite meet Paris are also probably out the window.
Well, Jeremy, I gather you're not going to disagree.
No.
All right. Well, on a completely separate note, not sure if you've had a chance to read the research done by Nicholas Fisher, a professor of marine sciences at Stony Brook University. He's found, and this is a back to coal here, that since coal-fired plants began shutting down in the U.S. in 2008, there's been a corresponding drop in the amount of mercury in tuna caught in the Gulf of Maine, and that is about 2% per year. Jeremy, any surprises here?
I didn't know that, but that I mean, that sounds, you know,
sounds
that,
like
that,
it makes sense.
That sounds like it makes sense. I think that's one of the things that climate activists have been trying to focus on, is that at the same time that coal plants and other sources of carbon pollution are you know, releasing carbon dioxide and warming the atmosphere, they're also releasing all of these other pollutants. Mercury is one of the big ones, and lots of other air pollutants that have much more immediate effects on human health and environmental health. And that's, you know, that was a big part of the EPA's justification for the Clean Power Plan and the claims that it would, you know, help improve public health.
Yeah. And Evan Lehman, as we kind of wind up the hour here, perhaps ending on a bit of an optimistic note, that, you know, California is aiming to reduce CO2 emissions 40% over the next 14 years. That's below 1990 levels. San Diego, the city, features a climate action plan which commits San Diego to 100% renewable energy by 2035. Is there a significant role? Again, you know, what can cities and states in the U.S. committed to the Paris Accord, you know, achieve if we pull out, you know, when Mr. Trump takes office?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think you're going to see a lot of local and state initiatives on climate change throughout his administration. And they're going to push him to, you know, not only accept the science, but also reduce emissions. And I think the cities and states are going to take a leadership role.
All right, Evan Lehman, deputy editor of Climate Wire at E&E News, an online media company which offers daily coverage of environmental and energy policy and market. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Shulman, senior project manager for Climate Desk, a project of Mother Jones Magazine. Our thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
And as always, if you get a chance, check out our Facebook page. You'll find it at whyy.org/radiotimes. And our podcasts are there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for this hour of Radio Times.